Binary Jazz, now on Catalina. We're back, and I'm here with two of my favorite people. That's Gary, Binary Gary on the internet, and Allison, Allison Plus on the internet. I am Chris, or Jazz Sequence on the internet, and this is a show about things that we talk about, and we don't know before we talk about them what we're talking about. And we try to make ourselves sound intelligent and usually fail.
Sounds a lot like my day job.
That's why this show is the thing that we do.
This is fun though. My day job is fun too. I didn't mean it that way. This is fun. I'm excited we're back. I can't contain myself. I'm throwing emoji everywhere.
We're also getting into the territory where the things that I bring to the table, I'm not fully sure that I actually know. Like, I've read about them, but even though I'm like, I don't know if I'm really fully understanding what's happening.
Yeah, that's all right.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Welcome to the club, I know.
Yeah. We'll learn together. Why is my camera low today? Maybe my camera's low.
Well, this is a podcast, so I don't know how much your camera matters, you know, that much. We don't get a huge amount of YouTube viewers.
Not even I watch it on YouTube.
Okay, then I'll put the camera back down again.
You want people to think you're taller.
So I went to Long Beach.
Woo! California!
And then Monterey for a day. That's where I was. I gave a presentation inside a pyramid, so that was cool.
I feel like that's a bucket list situation.
Yeah.
That you didn't know
you had.
Do you
feel like that helped?
Yes, the pyramid absolutely helped.
Because all the knowledge flows upward and to the point.
Exactly. Or alternately, it disperses down and spreads among all the people.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah, I had it backwards.
There was a Mythbusters where they did something with pyramids and levitation.
Yep. We were definitely
and it didn't
had
work. Levitation. Did you levitate by chance?
Levitation was happening. I was not one of the people levitating.
Man, that was quite the word camp.
I had a conversation with these guys, which is soundcheck.ai, which is a there's a speakable speakable element that you can add to content in every web page, and if your web page has a speakable element in it, then it can be accessed or queried against by like Alexa and Siri and like voice assistants, and that's the thing that they do. And they have a plugin that does it, and it's pretty.
Are you?
And hardly anybody is using it. Like, there's only it's like CNN and Fox News and a couple other like large media companies, and that's it. Pretty much.
Are you a big voice assistant user?
No. In fact, I unplugged my Google Home a while ago.
Yeah. I ask, there's in the Southeast running WordCamps, there is a group called something my voice, I don't know.
But I can definitely see the
idea.
Where a news agency, if they weren't already, would want to have their content speakable. Because if you say, "Hey Alexa, tell me what's going on in Turkey," and the only results you're getting are from CNN and Fox News, and that's it, then that's a missed opportunity to have people get name recognition and or go to your website or whatever. And there is some amount of, I mean, there's no universal standard in the technology because it's all really greenfields right now. But so there's no it's not necessarily going to tie you back to the actual source. But I guess Google Home, if you have a Google Home and an Android, then you ask for the question. You ask the question, it'll give you a response, and then it will pull up the article on your Android phone. So that you do have some like direct.
A couple years ago, there was a, maybe not a couple years ago, it wasn't that long ago, there was a, I read quite a few articles of people fiddling with Alexa and NWP plugins specifically, and working with the Alexa endpoint. And it seemed like it was, like all Amazon endpoints, it was pretty robust and therefore confusing. But I don't know. I'm not convinced this voice assist thing is going to be anything. I'm wrong already, obviously.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
For me, it's not going to be anything.
No, for me, it's not either. But I
use Siri when I'm driving. Like, hey, Siri, give me directions to, well, usually it's home from somewhere I am, and I want to get there with the least amount of traffic. And that's why I ask it, because traffic looks heavy. And it'll be like, take this route. And I'll go, all right. But when I have a self-driving car, like, I'm not going to ask Siri to do that. I'm just going to get in the car and do something else.
But I think that the people that interact with technology today are not necessarily the audience for the people who would make extensive use of voice assisted technology. I think that those are the people that would interact, that are going to interact with technology tomorrow. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, you're right. I mean, the future is tomorrow. That's fair. Like, it's not what's happening now. So
like because we have been interacting with technology for so long that Siri, Alexa, Google feels like an extra thing and weird privacy things, and like it doesn't fit into our day to day. Like, that's because that's where we're coming from. Whereas I think people who have grown up with this sort of technology being there, not using your hands is going to be an obvious solution. Like, of course I don't want to use my hands. What do you think I want to type? Case in point, that Star Trek where they went back in time, the Star Trek movie where they went back in time, and it was actually filmed at Monterey, so tie into my trip, you got Scotty at the plant that builds like plexiglass, and he goes to the computer and he picks up the mouse. I don't even have a mouse. I'm looking at my desk looking for the mouse so I can do Scotty. I don't even have a mouse on my desk.
Do you want this one?
Computer. Hello, computer. Because he doesn't understand, the computer doesn't speak English. You have to type, and then use the keyboard. Like, you can't fathom not having a speaking interaction with a computer. Right. Like, obviously it's the future. Star Trek predicted it in like 1990 something. Maybe 1980 something.
Yeah. So this is a show where we talk about things.
Mostly
and often Star Trek.
Star Trek and the Jetsons.
Well, I mean, those are the two models for the future that we need to base reality on. So, of course, we're talking
about given Star Trek and the Jetsons. Can we go with Star Trek?
Oh, Star Trek. So good.
The Jetsons seems a little, I don't know, like the 50s in the future, right?
That is probably the, like, actual definition of the Jetsons. That's the elevator pitch right there. It's like the 50s in the future.
Like, it's more, but like, what's the family model in the future? Star Trek doesn't really like focus too much on that. It's more just like,
oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Maybe Star Trek is post-family.
They have that like sweet daycare that you just kind of like all the kids go to.
Yeah. This is pretty rad.
Yeah. I've been reading in depth about a fictional city called Nibene in this D&D world that I am running a campaign in. And in Nibene, the family model is generally polygamous. So that's the thing. And businesses are like family run, and you sort of get more wives or husbands because you need more hands, essentially, or you need to pay off a debt or something.
And then the business.
Or have a debt paid off.
And then the businesses expand?
Yeah, because it's everybody in the family is basically responsible for the small business, and very rarely do you employ workers. You just employ your kids, and their kids sort of grow up in the business. Interesting. It's also polygamy goes both ways. It's not Not that you'd necessarily have multiple husbands and multiple wives, but there's usually a master of the house, and the master of the house can be male or female, and then that master of the house can have multiple of partners of opposite gender. Like, it's not just like male dominated patriarchal polygamy.
I was going to say old school polygamy, but then I was just like, kind of.
I mean, where I am, that would be accurate, but maybe, I mean, I old think polygamy,
polygamy,
I think
is such a great
dates
phrase.
Back longer than that, possibly.
I would listen to a folk band called Old School Polygamy.
I can guarantee that folk band would be based out of Utah.
I would, considering, I mean, it could also be a punk band. It could go either way.
Yeah, folk or considering, punk. Well, folk punk. Punk it folk. Could, yeah.
That sounds fantastic.
Considering we have a local brewer that makes polygamy porter.
Yeah, but it's like 2% because Utah, right?
No. I mean, yes, it was 3.2. But now it's going to be 4 because we upped our alcohol by volume content. To 4 because large breweries, but they might actually, I mean, they sell it out of state, and they sell a lot of things out of state, and they might actually make a non-Utah version. I don't know. Maybe not.
The Utah-free polygamy porter.
It's actually been banned in states that aren't Utah. It was banned in like Tennessee because they thought that it was like advocating for polygamy, and like, no, dude, it's a joke.
I feel like craft brewers in general just have such a great sense of humor in naming their product, and love when I hear stories of that, like their beer was banned because of the name. Oh, okay.
Well, the name and the label, like, the name and yeah. the label, because to be clear, the label also like has a dude and two wives, and like they're drinking beer or something.
I was semi-closed. We were at a family gathering. Ron and I were young, early in our marriage. We were at a family gathering, and this older great aunt of mine showed up with a bottle of Ménage à Trois wine. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't stop giggling.
Especially as it was every time I see that wine.
Yeah. And I just wonder, like, why is the wine industry, like, is it because it's wine that's fancier? And,
yeah.
Like, threesomes are okay in wine, but not in beer? Is that the deal? More accepted among wine drinkers.
There are certain societal rules in play here that who are we to question?
Well, I think generally
I just wish I knew what they were. I think
play with their names far less because it is sort of a higher echelon, like higher brow, like audience or perceived audience or like perceived like level of status. Whereas beer is like
beer's
normal
blue collar,
Joe's
right?
like alcohol.
Yeah, beer is blue collar, and it always has been, right?
Yeah,
it's fine. I don't.
But I would like to see more things that are like kind of poking fun at the genre in
establishment.
Wine. Yeah. Like there's a wine that we get a lot that we like a lot called Goats Do Roam.
Yes.
Which is a play on Goats Do Roam, which is a type of French wine. So it's. But like at the particular vineyard, I believe they're named because they have goats that roam around the vineyard. So it's called Goats Do Roam because it's like Goats Do Roam, but not.
Yes. It's brilliant. It's so good. That's exactly what I thought of when I was thinking of parody wine names. Yeah. Not parody, but wine names that are poking fun at.
Yeah.
Often when we are celebrating something, I will go get a bottle of wine, and I readily admit that I put way too much of my decision into the name on the bottle as to like versus anything else. And I always try and figure out like a theme to come home because sometimes it makes Rhonda laugh. More often makes me laugh. Sometimes she just puts up with it, and that's fair.
So you've never brought the Ménage à Trois bottle home? Like, hey, honey, conk.
I have not.
And she just gives you, seriously, Gary?
I'm trying to think of a good one, but I can't right now because I drank the wine and that interferes with memory or something. I don't know. I'll think of one in the middle of the show.
I like the idea of more anti-establishment once.
19 Crimes is pretty good at that. I mean, not that 19 Crimes is specifically anti-establishment in itself, but like their design and they so 19 Crimes is an Australian wine, and on the cork they list the 19 crimes that people were sent to Australia for committing. And so they have a couple of different things, and they're all like prison colony themed. So they have like the basic 19 crimes, and then they have the banished, and then they have the warden, and then they have something else.
I feel like the fact that it's an Australian wine like automatically makes it a little bit more likely to be tongue in cheek, you know?
Just because Australians are that way.
It's just a good sense of humor. Yeah. Australians have a generally, I'll stereotype the entire continent.
Yeah.
Why not?
Go for it.
Well, it goes hand in hand with my stereotype of they're getting ready. They could be killed at any moment by something poisonous. So they have to have a good sense of humor.
But they're really good clients, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. These are all positives, right? Oh, am I supposed to bring the topic to the table?
I mean, I think that we could also just not.
I've already forgotten what I was like. What did I write down? The topic for today is Latham Loop.
Latham Loop.
I was expecting you to pull up an envelope and be like, ah, yes.
That would be amazing. 1 week I should have somebody else come up with something, and so even I won't know what it is. That would be horrifying. No one will. Oh, and we won't have the answer.
Latham Loop is a sewing technique, I believe, that gives you nice doily and doilies. It's an edging sewing technique.
Sure.
I guess I'm pronouncing it Latham. It could be Latham.
Latham Loop. Also, sewing
totally
technique.
Totally different.
Well, I mean, that could be a thing, but I believe that loop is based on sort of the original when, like, spelling where it was like L-O, like U-P-E, or something, where it actually sort of meant like a lens. So a Latham loop is actually a type of lens that is specifically used for killing bugs.
Can we? Wow! Wow! I was not expecting that.
That's a real niche situation. Hun, get the laugh up.
It's much slower.
We're gonna be here for
like
about 15 minutes. Hold on.
Can we? Get
I'll
it,
get the fly. Don't worry about it.
How is it spelled?
L A T H A M. And loop, L-O-O-P.
It's two words.
It is two words.
Ah, there. Yes.
It's not like a loop-de-loop. It's a,
no,
not
it's
like a
Latham
loop.
Latham loop.
It's an ice skating maneuver.
A skating maneuver?
Ice skating, yeah.
Doing a loop?
Is well, there's like the toe loop and stuff. So there's a Latham loop where you use your Latham to loop.
Use your Latham?
Please, yes. Tell me.
The Latham a part of the costume?
What your Latham is.
Well, you know what the arch of the foot is?
Uh-huh.
Latham is the opposite side.
The opposite side of your arch. Okay.
Sure.
The bottom
so,
side.
So what you're saying is like the top.
No. Opposite the other, like the outside of your.
Like if this part's the arch. The bottom of your foot is what you're saying.
Right. I was trying to think about how I could get my foot up here near the camera, but using your hand makes a lot more sense than me trying to figure out how to contort myself to get my foot up here. Yeah.
I should have held off. I feel like that.
Oh, well. He like tumbles over.
How did he sprain his arm? Well.
Well, he was demonstrating the Latham loop.
Pretty intense podcasting. But the Latham loop was a 10 out of 10.
He stuck the landing. Stuck the landing.
Okay.
It's realistically, it's probably like a sciencey thing, right? A lot of things we haven't learned about are sciencey, correct?
I love that you're approaching this from a realistic standpoint, as if that has ever helped the situation.
I mean, I feel like going with a knitting technique is probably closest to the mark, but sure, we can go down the road of yeah, it's science-y.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe I don't want to do that then. Fine.
In programming, when you create, you know, there's flying V's. Mm-hmm. A flying V is actually a Latham loop. It's a programming technique. And for those of you that aren't programmers, a flying V in programming is when you have a conditional, and then inside that conditional, you nest another conditional, and then nest another conditional, and another, and another, and another, until when you compress all of the code inside the conditionals besides just the conditionals, and you just see the conditionals, it looks like a big sideways V, like a flying V guitar.
Boy, even just talking about that makes my skin crawl. I'm so anti-nesting. I mean, if you're two levels deep, I'm wondering why is there not a guard clause in place? So, I'm
so that's, it's right it's now. It's actually.
It turns out I'm very opinionated on code.
It's actually Latham loop is actually sort of a hypothetical exercise. It's a programming exercise to demonstrate how problematic that type of code is. Latham loop.
Invented by that nobody went programming before ice skating.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a little bit of an obvious hot take. It was invented by Peter J. Latham. That is that Peter Jackson Latham.
I was gonna say, what's the J short for?
jQuery.
Peter Jackson Latham invented the Latham loop in a fit of rage when he was doing a code review back in 1952.
Were there 4-H loops in 1952?
Sure. I have not written COBOL, so my programming history goes back to like original BASIC, and that's as far back as it goes.
Yeah, I too have not written COBOL.
I feel like, I mean, I don't even know if COBOL is what they wrote in 1952, but I feel like probably.
It seems likely, doesn't it?
Sure. It's one of those, I mean, in reality, what they actually wrote is probably something that we don't even like recognize the name of anymore. But like, because COBOL is the thing that we all know is old, that's immediately what we think is the thing. Oh yeah, 1952, everybody wrote COBOL.
Or they just wrote like directly in assembly. Yeah. There was a dude.
1001.
On the internet.
1101.
In the early days of the internet that wrote.
It's like a weird fairy tale. Once upon a time, there was a dude on the internet.
Gibson Research. I think his name was Steve Gibson, and he wrote a lot of weird utilities. One of them was the thing that helped recover data from zip drives after the click of death happened. But he wrote really, really low-level stuff, like in assembly, and then compiled it to executable. So there were these amazing programs that ran in like several, like a handful of kilobytes in instead of megabytes for what they accomplished. It was bizarre. I don't know why I remember that. I just remember thinking at the time, like, it seems like an awful lot of work to write directly in assembly. I think it was assembly.
It was.
I don't know. It was. Do you remember GRC? Yeah.
I just know that I learned that assembly was a class that I took in college, and it sucked.
Yeah. Well, I know assembly.
I could not imagine writing anything assembly.
Yeah, I was just thinking about GRC, and I don't know if you're familiar with that. They had another thing, too. Shields Up, I think it was, maybe. Remember that plugin? Or not plugin. Application in the Windows days.
Okay. It's a great name, though.
I learned Motorola assembly, so my assembly is probably totally different than my assembly experience is pretty platform specific.
Yeah. I fortunately quit college before I had to learn assembly, so.
I didn't have to either. That was the fun thing. It's like I did it by choice. And did it before C++, so like that was weird.
My school had, I don't know, computer science or computer information systems were the two degrees you could get in the computer science department. The information systems, like the difference was like if you had to take the operating systems course or the databases course. And I thought that the the operating system's core sounded really awesome. And the database's core sounded pretty like blah. And now in reality, I'm like, I mean, not that college wasn't reality. It kind of wasn't reality. Now in reality, I'm like, I don't have the desire to ever write an operating system and or work on writing an operating system. But like databases I use, you know, like constantly and...
I view databases as like kind of your job.
Yeah. Like, hi, I'm Gary and I like atomic data and storing it in easy to find ways. And that definition is constantly changing. So like that's, yeah. Yes.
The college you didn't know.
There was a lot I didn't know in college.
In college, I was convinced that what I was going to do was not going to be anything having to do with computers. Not directly. And like, I certainly wasn't going to be a developer or a web developer or anything. That was not what I was going to be. Certainly not.
So I my takeaway from college was that I was not smart enough to be a developer. So
I think that's like a pretty average response to development in college.
Yeah. So, I mean, that sucks. I guess that's why I'm not anti-college. Yeah, I'm kind of anti-college. Someone wants to go, and they have a good reason. Cool. But, like, it ain't for me.
I also
I'm
feel like...
I'm not going to finish a degree.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I feel like it does not... It's not the right approach to learning software development.
And there's a big gap between software development and computer science.
Yeah.
Like, whatever.
We're at that time to learn what the Latham loop is.
Okay, so the Latham loop, it's used in film projection, and it basically isolates the film strip from vibrating and too much tension and prevents it from snapping.
The loop.
So basically it allowed long movies.
I actually know what this is. Yeah.
So yeah, it's a tensioner.
It's so the film is not super taut when it's going through the projector. It allows for some slack so that, because projectors get super, super hot and it can potentially melt the film. So they need to have something to loosen it. So that it isn't super tense, so that there's less of a possibility that when the projection is running that it's just going to pull apart.
And there's a really interesting story behind like the patent and Edison being a real jerk. Classic Edison.
Classic Edison.
But I was reading that I will post in our Slack. But
yes,
interesting. Oh, I think the backstory and Edison being a jerk was more interesting about how the patent was made and then lost and how he was really trying to like put a stronghold on all these things and the loop tried to prevent it basically.
When I worked at the
Why do you keep company, waving a, what is that? A sour?
It's a piece of wire. I've been fiddling. I have all sorts of like crap related to Raspberry Pi up here on my desk and I can't
Your
not
desk
place
was
it.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I hear some extra fans, and I'm missing a fan. There's one fan. Oh, here's a 5-volt, 8-amp power supply. There's a bunch of crap on my desk at the moment. I'll clean it off later, I promise.
I'd like to see a photo. I feel like my desk is comparable, except I have like gems and tarot cards. So
I have screwdrivers and a Kindle with an advertisement on the screen and a dead Raspberry Pi, and yeah, it's. I'll drop a photo in later on. An embarrassing photo of my desk. When I used to work downtown at the company that brought things in and sold them on the internet, we expanded, and one of the properties we bought was the old film distribution place. And so the building had like an office where people would come in, and then down this hallway there were these rooms that were they were like bricked in completely except for a door that was made out of asbestos, and the shelves were where you could put the reels because this film was highly flammable. And then at the top was a chimney. So if any room caught on fire, they could vent that one and close off the others to preserve all the rest of the film. So they would only lose like, you know, 15 or 20% of the inventory at once in case of fire. So super fascinating building, super cancer causing building with the asbestos in there. We mostly used it to store like replacement pieces for larger products we sold. And tried to stay out of there. When we originally acquired the building, there was a tail section of an airplane in it. So it was weird, like a lot of things in that area of Jacksonville.
That's legitimately weird, though.
Yeah, it was. I remember cleaning it out, like someone like yanked out this like tail section of an airplane, like take it to the scrapper, see how much cash we can get for it. Like, that was it. That was the solution. It's metal. We can recycle it.
So we have some listener feedback.
Feedback. I don't like where this is going. Oh no.
The first one I'm going to read because it's an obvious, it's obviously spam, but I'm going to read it because that's what we do when you email us. We will read your email on the show and share it with the rest of the podcast listening world. So this one comes from Joan. And she says, hi there, my name is Joan. I am an editor at Tips Bulletin, one word. While researching articles on ants, I noticed your link from this page, Grawlix, episode 10111, to a get rid of ants resource on why don't you try this, one word. We recently published an extensive article covering 8 easy ways to get rid of fire ants. Is a quick read and might be worth a link from your page. Here's the link. If you add a link to our post, please let me know. And we will share your article with our 1.7 Mio followers on our Home Tips World, one word, network, yeah. Facebook page, https://home-tips-world.
It's eight tips on how to get rid of fire ants?
8 easy ways to get rid of fire ants.
Can you share that with me?
Yes.
Grawlix is the answer. Clearly.
I look forward to hearing from you, Joan Clark, editor, tipsbulletin.com, Home Tips World Network.
Okay.
Well, Joan, I've read your post, your email on the air. We will not be posting a link to your article. I will be sharing it with Gary, though, and then he might share it on his own or not.
There's very little chance I'll share it on my own. I've tried a lot of things, and I'm just curious if there's anything in that list that I haven't tried.
I have mentioned your Facebook page, so there you go. But you're not getting a link from us. Sorry.
If you have a spike in traffic, thank us.
It's not going to happen.
But like a wind spike dripping through the heart. Happy Halloween.
Speaking of Halloween, Halloween's coming up. So we have a Halloween themed question from Allison.
Yes.
Was
that the feedback? That was it? We're done with feedback?
That was the only thing that wasn't an Allison question.
Oh, okay.
I can give you feedback if you want more.
The Binary Jazz Trio were to dress up for Halloween, what other trio would you want them to dress up as?
Oh, I like this.
Three's Company.
Yeah, okay. Three's Company. Would
be Allison could be Jack.
I didn't even think of Three's Company. That would be a great idea.
I was thinking of like, you know, there's not a lot of really good trios, and for some reason, Three's Company was the first thing that popped into my mind immediately following. There aren't very many good trios. There's nothing. Which I don't know that that's necessarily contradicting that initial thought of not a lot of good trios.
No, I don't believe so. I don't know that I have a good one.
I mean, there's the obvious three Amigos or Three Stooges.
Yeah.
I thought there's three in the title. It's like,
yeah. I thought that Three's Company worked well though because of the gender difference inherent in Three's Company. And then that could be flipped for our trio.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gender bending Three's Company.
Yeah.
I feel like
it's how we roll.
Yeah. It just has to be it.
That works.
All right. True. So next Halloween party that we all go to together.
Well, now at least we've got it settled. We don't have to
Right.
You know.
We avoided that meeting, thankfully.
So I'll be
confirming and energy is just taken care of now.
I'll be Suzanne Summers.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Clearly. Get some balloons.
Choice to wit.
Some water balloons.
It's hard because like the other trios, I don't know. There's like the three witches from Hocus Pocus. There's
Three Musketeers.
Three Musketeers.
You could go like less like solidified, like you could do like Harry Potter and Ron and Ginny, like, or you there could you do go. You could do from Pirates of the Caribbean, Jack and Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley.
My wardrobe
that's a bit ambitious.
Like one step away from a pirate at any time. Like if I add a pirate hat or maybe just like one more scarf.
Thank you for listening to Binary Jazz. If you like this episode, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can visit us online at binaryjazz.us or follow us on Twitter at binaryjazz. Don't forget that you can ask us a question through the form on the website or on Twitter, and we'll read it aloud on the next episode of Binary Jazz.